And he said, yeah, but he said, I've got a less than honorable discharge from the Army. I said, you know, 3 years from now you can reapply and they'll change it. And I said, you know, you're very fortunate. I said, I know you don't feel that way, but you're very fortunate. You've broken very little in your life. And he couldn't see it. He was too far gone. The next day, I went to a prison to visit a guy that I sponsor. He's got 2 years now. He's been in prison for 30 years. And we're working on his eight-step list. And as we'll talk about later when we get to the eighth step, the getting ready in the eighth step is forgiving. Forgiving. You know, the great secret to grace and happiness and peace of mind is forgiveness. And I was talking to him about forgiveness, and he'd forgiven someone who'd done him a great wrong. And he began to cry. And he said to me, it's amazing to me that I've been given this and I've suffered so little to get it. Here's a man who's been in prison longer than this man I talked to the night before had been alive. And he had seen that his 30 years in prison and everything else was a small price to pay for what he had. And I always think of one of my favorite scriptures about the jewel of great price. And that's what sobriety is. Sobriety is a jewel of great price. And before you buy it, the price is too great. After you acquire it, there's no price too great. And the difference has nothing to do with anything except the grace of God. It's the possession of the great gift that makes the price meaningless. And so that's why this whole process of recovery, this sobriety, these steps, looking at it from the alcoholism end, it looks impossible. Well, a couple days, and I'm sure that to this wonderful woman, this looks impossible. We have people here who are sober 37 years or whatever. And from that perspective, you'd ask, who wouldn't pay for this? Who wouldn't buy this? We pay so little to get here once we've been here. And I think it's one of the great, great mysteries, the great spiritual mysteries. You know, it's not unlike the martyrs and the saints and on, who lived very, very difficult lives, overcame tremendous things. And they always felt guilty because what they've been given was so freely given. But I bet if you set any one of them down and said to them, look, you can be a saint one day, but this is what you have to do. They'd say, got any other jobs? I know they would, you know. Because from that end, it looks impossible. From the other end, we wonder why we waited so long. Why did I wait so long to do that third step? You know, why did I wait so long to do a spiritual inventory? You know, why did I wait so long to share this with God and myself and another human being? You know, why did I wait so long to become entirely ready to have God remove these defects of character? You know, once they're gone, we'll say, well, I didn't want that anyway. All that ever did was cause me grief. I don't know why I hung on to it for so long. You know, the sixth and seventh step, of course, is the process, and it's the process we're talking about now. And I want to talk a little bit more about it when we get together this afternoon. But let me say this about it. And if you read the transcript of the original Big Book, if you don't, I would urge you to get a copy of the transcript, the original transcript of the Big Book. It's interesting. Anybody here read it? Have you read it? It's a fascinating thing. And the story I'm told about it is that Bill took it to a psychiatrist friend. I don't know who it was. I don't know if it was Harry Thiebaud or who it was. But it was written the way I hear people talking, some people talking to alcoholics, you know. You will, you know, with the, like, everything but the finger wagging, you know. And that's the way it was written. And so they took it, and the psychiatrist looked at it and said, well, this is interesting, but this isn't what you guys do. So what do you mean? It's what we do. No. You don't tell people what they need to do. You tell them what you did. You share with them what you did. And why is that important? I think it's important because when we talk about what we did, we recognize how easy it was to do. When we tell someone what they must do, we're giving them impossible tasks. Impossible tasks. You know, I was going to talk about this in the 12th step, but I had a wonderful example of this not too long ago. One of the things I like to do is, we have a teaching hospital in the nor hometown. And I like to go to the person who puts a curricula together for the teaching hospital. And I always say to him, you know, I'm a longtime member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm not an old timer, but I'm a longtime member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I said, if your interns, if you want, I'd be glad to talk to your interns about Alcoholics Anonymous and what we do. And they're always glad for people to do things like that. So I'll talk to a group of incoming interns. And these are all bright-eyed kids, who bright kids and ready to go, you know. And I talk to them about Alcoholics Anonymous and tell them I have cards, not business cards, but personal cards with my name and phone number. And if you ever have anybody who might want to talk to a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, I said, I'll be glad to talk to them. I said, if it's a woman, I said, I know plenty of women who are marvelous members of Alcoholics Anonymous. They'll come and talk to them. Well, I get a call one day from a young girl, and she said, I hate to bother you. This is Dr. So-and-so, and you spoke to our group about Alcoholics Anonymous. And she said, we have a man that, he's totally non-communicative. And the only rise that we've gotten out of him at all is we asked him if he'd be willing to speak to a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and he nodded his head. And she said, you probably don't want to bother because he isn't willing to listen. And I said, I'll be right there. Well, you know, I like to put on a tie in situations like that, or at least get dressed up. And so I put on a tie, and I went over there, and the young girl met me, and she said, I brought his chart. Would you like to have a look at his chart? I says, no, I know what's in his chart. So she took me to his room, and there's a guy laying in bed looking at the ceiling, just laying there, had his robe and pajamas on. He's just laying there looking at the ceiling. And had those paper slippers on. Why he had those on, I don't know, but he hadn't gone anywhere. But probably getting ready. So she began to lecture him. She said, now, John, this man is coming. He's taking time out of his day to come here to talk to you. And I said to her, thank you very much. So then she starts to pull up a chair, and I said, could you excuse us, please? She looked a little bit shocked, you know, and so she left. And she closed the door almost. She kept it slightly ajar. And she was lurking out there. You know how people lurk, you know? My wife lurks. She's a lurker. If I'm sick, you know, I'll go to the guest room or something if I'm sick and I don't want to infect her. And she lurks outside. I hear her lurking. And she just loves me, so, you know, she lurks outside the door. Well, this doctor was lurking out there. And so I did what we do, you know. I mean, it isn't about this guy talking. He's not doing a 12-step call. I'm doing a 12-step call. So I just sit down and I began to share my experience with, you know, my drinking. And I was talking about my drinking. I talked about the progression, like the book says. It's very simple, you know. And then I talked about Harvard Street. And this man looked at me and he said, Harvard Street in Washington? And I said, yeah. And he said, I lived on Columbia Road. I said, no. He said, when were you there? And I said, well, I said 1973. He said, me too. And I said, where'd you buy your booze? Did you go to Columbia, Ontario Liquor Store? He said, yeah, on Columbia Road. I said, yeah. And I said, remember the big barrel they had? He said, yeah, 3/5 for $10. I said, yeah, the good stuff. And we're really talking, you know, and pretty soon he's sitting up on the side of the bed and we're talking and stuff. And we were laughing and everything. So we talked for a little bit longer, and I said, would you mind if I came back tomorrow? He said, oh, I wish you'd come. I said, look, I got a couple of friends I know would like to meet you. They get along well with you. Would you mind if I bring them? Oh, I'd love it if you'd bring them. Thank you, sir, for coming, and on. And why leave? And this girl is just beside herself. She can't believe it. She said, that's the most magnificent thing I've ever seen. And she'd gone and gotten a few of the other interns, and they're all sort of gathered together, and she's filling them in. And, you know, I love it. They wear stethoscopes around their necks, so you'll know they're doctors and not high school students, you know. And she said, would you be willing to do a workshop for us on how you do that? And I said, I'd be glad to. I said, are you willing to do some homework? She said, oh, yeah. I said, you have to drink real bad for at least 10 years, you know. And I went on to explain that this gift we have isn't about what we learn. It's about what we've done. I mean, I said to her, I said, I'm sure you're a wonderful doctor. And I said, if you don't mind a suggestion, I said, wherever you go to practice medicine, I said, meet a couple men and a couple women who are members of Alcoholics Anonymous and get their numbers. I said, I can't do much of anything, but I can do this. I said, God has given me this special gift just because of where I've been. Not because of who I am, but because of where I've been. My great value in the eyes of God, it's one of his son, but also the fact that I've been where I've been. Not because he wanted me to be there. I went in spite of him. But since he's been there and he brought me back, I have things to say. I have a message to carry. One of my favorite stories in the Bible is the prodigal son and how he came back. I can't read that without weeping. And I often wonder what it must have been like after that. You know, I imagine he went and made amends to his brother. You know, he said, you know, you were here and you were responsible and you hung out with Dad and you stuck with him and I was out goofing off and blowing the fortune and everything. Can I do anything to make that right? And I know his brother, because of the example of his father, would have to forgive him. You know. Then he'd say something like my brother said to me, God, we're proud of you. We're so proud of you. But then I wonder what he did the rest of his life. I think the value was he'd been there. Can't you imagine it? Maybe somebody lived in an ex-farm, said, I'm going to take half my fortune and I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that. And he said, let me share my experience and strength with you. You know, now you may have to do that, but maybe you won't have to do that. That's the beauty of that. You know, for years I loved the fact that he was taken back because I needed it to be taken back. And I loved the fact that he was forgiven and they killed the fatted calf and they put a ring on his finger because I'm into stuff. You know, and I love the fact that he talked to Dumb Denny, put him down, you know, Dad talked to Dumb Denny and said, look, your brother who was lost has been found. Stop whining. But that isn't where it ends. I think where it ends is what he did with that great gift, the great gift of being brought back. And that's why I think it's critically important that we understand what it is and what we're about, and that what we're about is much bigger than us. It's much bigger than coming home and sitting with a woman you love in front of the fireplace and talking about the weekend. It's about spending, if you have to, even spend a night in Atlanta with a bunch of Democrats. I mean, you know, whatever it takes, you know, whatever it takes to make the phone call, to be of service. That's the stuff that's important, I think. And the reason I like to talk about this is, frankly, retreats about the 12 steps concern me. Because it's often seen as something I go away and learn or something I go away and do. And that's not what it is. It's something I live on a daily basis. Our sponsors ought to be teaching us about the 12 steps in the book. And I know many of our sponsors did. That's where it needs to be learned. I think it's nice to discuss these principles in places like retreats. And I think retreats are good for just that, to retreat and reassess and reevaluate. But I think that the beauty of the 12 steps is that a man who grew to love me and who I grew to trust, maybe the first person I trusted in a long time, took me by the hand and walked me through these things and lived it with me day in and day out. That's the value and the beauty of this. You know, I have a close friend who asked me to always remember something, and that is the fifth tradition. It says each group has but one primary purpose, and that's to carry this message to the alcoholic who still suffers. That's what it's for me. It's not to be happily married, though I am. It's not to be a father whose children has largely forgiven him, so they have. You know, it's not to be a son that my parents are proud of, though they are. It's to carry the message to the still suffering alcoholic. That's my primary purpose, and that's the purpose of my home group. When we do our group inventory, the question we ask ourselves is, what are we doing for the newcomer? We give great parties. We have great fellowship. But when you are a newcomer and you walk into our group, do you feel welcome? You know, do you feel like this is a place that you might be accepted and cared about? It's to carry the message to the newcomer. Carry the message to the person who still suffers. May or may not be a newcomer, huh? I've done a lot of suffering late in life. But that's the value of all of this. And I like to say that just basically as a cautionary note. I do a fair number of 12-step retreats and things, and I love them. But don't, you know, the 12 steps is a way of life. It's the way we live. It isn't what we go away and do. My favorite retreats are silent retreats, for obvious reasons. I don't have to talk. But they really are. When I retreat, I like to go away to a silent retreat. And I'd recommended that to a friend here, that you go. And I'll tell you why it's important is, I spend my whole life getting ready to react to you, just like I spent my whole life getting ready to react to life. I was like the pinball in a pinball machine. Whichever bumper I hit, that's the direction in which I went, you know. And that's what life tended to always do to me. And I'd hit a bumper and I'd head this way and I'd start preparing myself for the next thing I was going to run into. Well, silent retreat's nice because I go there as a Friday evening, you don't talk. And somewhere during Saturday, it occurs to me that I don't have to prepare myself for the next encounter. I don't have to get myself ready to meet somebody or to talk to somebody. I can just be. And a great silence settles over you, and it's a wonderful thing, and I'd urge you to do that. And again, I don't want to rain on this in any way, shape, or form. It's an honor for me to be here. I think it's critically important that we understand that this isn't how we do the steps. This is how we get ideas, and we talk about them, and we share experiences. But the way we do the steps is with our sponsors. Okay? I think it's time for lunch, isn't it?
Time for Mass.
Time for Mass. Okay, thank you very much. Okay. I'd like to spend a little bit more time on steps 6 and 7. I think that 6 and 7 are basically viewed as unimportant steps by a lot of people because it seems, well, it seems abstract, certainly, but it also seems less traumatic in a way than 4 and 5 and 8 and 9. And, you know, some of those things where we could be embarrassed. I mean, you know, you could downright be embarrassed about these things. And 6 and 7 appears to be sort of a throwaway. And there are a couple of things I'd like to say about 7. The beauty of 7, as Happy Harold would say, is that the worst becomes our greatest gift. And if you look at the prayer, the 7-step prayer in the book Alcoholics Anonymous, it says, take all of us, the good and the bad, and use us. And yet, I was a guy who spent his whole life thinking I was supposed to prepare to do something. I was supposed to be perfect. And if I wasn't perfect, or if I didn't do it perfectly, I couldn't do it at all. And what I've come to realize is that the majority of my effectiveness is the way I bungle through life. And people look at me and say, and if he can get through life, anybody can get through life. And that's what I think the 7-step tells us, that what we admire in people is their trying. You know, what we admire in people. You imagine, I talk to alcoholics all the time, including alcoholics here, right? And I run into a group of people who maybe 4, 5, 10, 15, 20 years ago thought of nothing but themselves. And now are concerned because they don't think they're quite as good as God would like them to be. I think that's a significant change in a human being's life. I really do. And it shows that this program works. The 6th step is, again, just a continuing effort to change myself and the failure of doing it. I'm going to make myself different. I'm not going to lie. You know, now that I know I don't need to lie, now that I know that lying isn't good for me, I'm not going to lie anymore. 10 minutes later, I'm lying. And my head is saying to my mouth, you don't need to, you don't do this. And my mouth saying, you shut up, you stay out of this, you know. I may need to remember how to do this later on, you just never know. And that's it. And a friend of mine said to me one time that the 6th and 7th step are the most frustrating thing that he ever did. I said, well, If you're demanding perfection, I imagine that's so. But if you look at a guy who used to live his life based purely on self-will, and now you're struggling and really caring about being changed, being made better, you really care about character building, I think that in itself says a lot. I think that says a lot. And I'll tell you why I think it's critical. I think it's critical because of step 8. Step 7, it says, we had lacked the perspective to see the character building and spiritual values had to come first, and that material satisfactions were not the purpose of living. And I didn't know that. I always knew that security for me would never be poor like I was when I was a kid. Security to me would never be embarrassed or ashamed about the way I was dressed or about the way my parents were dressed. And I knew that if I had that, you know, a pair of Gucci shoes and some, you know, the right kind of clothes and that sort of thing, I knew if I had that, I'd be secure. I remember when I go to the theater and I put on my After 6 to go to the theater, I knew I was going to be secure, you know, because I had material things. And, you know, I mean, after all, if you're wearing a tuxedo and you're going to the theater, you're, you know, you're headed in the right direction. A year later, I was living on 14th and Harvard Street. But, I mean, yeah, what the heck. Nearly all A's have found, too, that unless they develop much more of this precious quality, humility, than may be required just for sobriety, they still haven't much of a chance of becoming truly happy. So happiness doesn't require that I have a lot of material things. Happiness is, happiness happens as a result of living a life based on humility. Seldom do we look at character building as something desirable in itself, something we would like to strive for whether our instinctual needs were met or not. We never thought of making honesty, tolerance, and true love of man and God the daily basis of living. I was talking to a friend of mine just not long ago, and I was telling her about my prayer every morning. And part of my prayer every morning is that I ask God to let me love my wife more than she loves me. And every night I feel like I fail. I remember that and I think this is important because of my past, but I remember I was doing some work and I was in Wilmington. We were then living in Fayetteville, and I was doing some work, and I had called her. I'd gone to dinner with a group of friends, and I called her just to tell her how things were going. I'd see her, and she said, "I'll see you this evening." And then we went on to dinner, and I got back to this place I was working. I was doing some workshops for them, and it was about 7 in the evening or something like that. And I got this, the secretary came in and said, "There's an emergency call." And I called my wife back, and she was crying, and her mother had passed away. And I said, "I'll be right there." I said, "It takes 2 hours, and I'll be there." And I called a guy I sponsor, David, and he and his wife went over and sat with her. They took chicken. If someone dies in the South, fried chicken appears. It just happens that way. But they went over. They got chicken and went over. And if you see someone carrying fried chicken into someone's house, you know someone's passed. But I drove up there. I just dropped everything, of course. And I drove up there. And on the way up, I was thinking about how it had been some years earlier. I got home one night at midnight, and of course I was drunk. And the woman I was married to then was sitting on the floor. And the floor around her was wet from tears because her father had died, and she found out about it at 4:30. And she waited from 4:30 till midnight for her husband to come home. And I'm sober now. And I ask by the grace of God I never be a husband like that again. And so I was there, and that night I held her all night as she cried. And the next day we got up early and we went over to where her parents lived, and we began making all the arrangements. And her dad was sort of wandering around, so she kind of took over and made all the arrangements. And I was with her every step of the way. And so I'm thinking, this is one day I'm going to show her I love her more than she loves me. And I've been looking for this for a long time. And that night I was holding her in bed, kissed her goodnight. We said our prayers together. I kissed her goodnight, and she rolled over to go to sleep, and then she rolled back over, and she put her arms around me, and she said, "Forgive my selfishness." She said, "I'm thinking of myself, and I forgot how much you love Mother, too." And I thought, damn. I missed again. But that's the basis of life. That's why you want to live life on a spiritual basis. The way I grew up, and this isn't what I was taught, but this is the way I grew up, okay? The way I grew up was... you played one-upsmanship, and you had to watch out for yourself. And you wouldn't bother worrying about what somebody else was feeling because you got to get yours. And and all the spiritual principles involved were they'll take advantage of you if they can. So your job is to not let them use you, and on and on and on. And I mean, I made up most of this stuff, but that's the way I live my life. Don't trust them. Be jealous. All those crazy, crazy rules for living. And now I don't have to do that, because what I do now is I do precisely what this book says. It says that we never thought of making honesty, tolerance, and true love of man and God our daily basis for living. I love the question they ask in this book: what would the Master do? If I can ask that question, what would the Master do? If I can ask that question, I make better decisions if I don't ask the question. The old question was, hey, where's mine? What's going to happen to me? That whole business is self-centered fear. I'm a pretty disciplined guy in certain ways, but I know that there are some things that don't yield to discipline. I think discipline is the foundation of a spiritual life. If I don't take the time I need to do the praying that I need to do, and that takes a discipline, and on and on, turning off the TV to do the reading at night or to do my 10-step, those are disciplined things. But I can't flog myself into changing. And that's what I used to think I could do. I remember I was going to quit smoking. Well, it never occurred to me that God would help me do that. Never occurred to me. And so what I did was I decided one day that I was never going to quit quitting smoking. You know, I wasn't going to be one of these, all right, I fail, I go buy six more cartons. It wasn't going to happen. Every time I lit a cigarette, I asked God, make this the last cigarette, please. And when I lit another one, I said, make this the last cigarette. And one day it was the last cigarette. One day it was the last cigarette. That was it. And that's, I allowed God to do for me what I couldn't do. Okay, and that's the basis of the seventh step. The question of the seventh step is this. What's my goal? And the answer is easy. My goal is perfection. Will I ever get there? Of course not. That's where the humility comes in. The humility comes in because I'll never be perfect. But my goal is to never lie or to mislead another person again. I'll fail, but that's my goal. It isn't to be a better liar or to lie about less important stuff. It's to not lie at all. It's to, you know, to not lie at all. That's my goal. But I'll fail. But then I'll pick myself up and I'll ask God to forgive me and I'll ask what corrective measures need to be taken. And then I go on with my life. I want never, ever to ever violate a vow of my marriage. Do I do it? Yes, sometimes I do. Sometimes I'm not as attentive to my wife as I think I need to be. Sometimes I'm more involved in a football game than what it is she's talking about. You know, just the way it is. Football is just more exciting a lot of times than marriage. Sorry, I can't help it. It's just the way, that's the nature of football. But you know, I promise to love, to honor, and obey. Am I showing something that's less than loving? Yeah. Then I need to do what I can do to correct that. And what I'll often do is go later and say, Julia, I'm sorry, hon, I was watching the game. I didn't hear everything you had to say. I want to make sure that I know what it is that you want to tell me. And we sit down and talk about it. She'll say, I should know better than to talk to you while you have one ear in the football game, you know. So she doesn't personalize it, thank goodness. But do I do that? Of course I do. But my goal is one day to love her perfectly. I'll never do that. But that's my goal. It isn't to worry about who's ahead or who's winning. And that's the way I always live my life. Not to be taken advantage of. That means not doing everything I want to do. We could actually, now this whole thing about religion too is and I love religion. You may have picked up on that. I really do. But you know, religion to the unrecovered mind like mine was a disaster. Absolute disaster. What I heard were a lot of things I could beat people up with. And it says we actually have earnest religious beliefs, which remain barren because we're still trying to play God ourselves. I knew what was best for other people. As long as we place self-reliance first, a genuine reliance upon a higher power was out of the question. The basic ingredient of all humility, a desire to seek and do God's will, was missing. You know, that's the whole theme of our literature in Alcoholics Anonymous. If you read page 86, 87, 88, when they talk about the 11th step, they talk about how we will intuitively know, will come to realize how to handle situations that were difficult. And it's because we come to rely upon God. And it says we'll make mistakes, particularly in the beginning, we'll make a lot of mistakes. I remember I used to have all these wonderful ideas. They'd just come to me. It was like a burst of brilliance. And I'd write them down. And I'd take them to my friend Dick Corcoran. Dick's passed away now, but we were long, God, good friends in Alcoholics Anonymous. He's the one who taught me to read the big book again and to do a lot of things. And Dick and I'd be best friends. And I'd say, Dick, I got a great idea. He'd say, great, let's go to Chick-fil-A. We used to go to Chick-fil-A in the mall to break our diets when I had great ideas. And I'd sit there and I'd lay the idea. And I'll never forget. And Dick would, it was a very kind man. And he would just sit there and listen to me through the whole thing. I remember one time I had this idea. It was going to revolutionize something. I can't remember what it was, but it was a brilliant idea. And I ran it past him, and he's sitting there, and we looked, and this woman was walking by, and she was absolutely stunning, just a stunning woman. And she walked by, and we watched her walk by, and Dick turned to me, and he said, well, there she is, God's will for me. And I knew exactly what he was getting at. You know, this brilliant idea of mine was the way the world would run if I were God. And what I hadn't asked was God's will in this deal. And whenever I'm off on these flights of fancy, I always leave God out of it. It was like my sponsor told me early on. He said, you're allowed to pray for something if it'll help other people. But you can't pray for stuff if it's just to help you. So I prayed to win the Irish sweepstakes so I could help other people. It says, a whole life geared to self-centeredness cannot be set in reverse all at once. Rebellion dogs every step. Rebellion is that part of us that says, I got a better idea. Well, how about me? Everywhere we saw failure and misery transformed by humility into priceless assets. We heard story after story of how humility had brought strength out of weakness. In every case, pain had been the admission into the new life. And, you know, when they talk about the character defects in the seven deadly sins, in the 12 and 12, they always talk about pride heading the list. And a man challenged me. The man who heard my fifth step challenged me to find a character defect I had that pride was not involved. And I couldn't do it. Pride is involved with every character defect that I have. So the thing that I like to pray for is humility. To pray for humility. And God will give us humility. And it doesn't mean that we'll be humbled or embarrassed every time. It isn't. You know, you'll get an inkling of... I can tell you, one of the first things I did was I used to compete in a grocery store. I don't know if anybody ever does this, but you know, you got to pick the shortest line, and then, you know, you got to beat the old lady with the cart to that line, you know. And, you know, and there's sort of... You don't want to appear as though you're racing the old lady, but... Because, I mean, that would look tacky, you know. That's not at all you know, that doesn't at all jive with the image I want to have, you know. But I want to beat that old lady. And you know, and one day I said to myself, I'm going to let her go first. And then one day later, I not only said, I'm going to let her go first. I said, I'm not going to let her know I did it, you know. Because my first attempt was to run up there and then stop and say, you go first, madam. Because I'm that kind of guy. Real humility would act like I wasn't even thinking about leaving yet and letting her go first. Now, that doesn't cost anything. That doesn't cost anything. Yet those are practices. The nuns used to talk to us about practicing little things like that. Picking up a piece of paper because it's there. I do that. I see a piece of paper lying someplace, I pick it up and put it in a trash can. And I just said, well, it's not my paper, I didn't put it there. Why don't you get the guy who put it there? He's the one who ought to pick it up. But no, now what I try to do is just do that. I try to do things like that because those are the things that build character. And I try to do things when nobody's watching the way I would do them when they're watching. And that's what the seventh step is. The seventh step is to do things the way God would have me do them, even if I don't get found out. I love our friends in Al-Anon have that just for today. I love that. Today I'm going to do something nice for somebody and not let them know. And these are practices. I try to do things that my wife would do otherwise and not let her know about them. For example, you know, I'll like, you know, if I know she's going to change the bed or something, I'll change the bed. But she always catches me. She always says, honey, thank you for changing the bed. It's all right. It's nothing. I'm just being spiritual. I just like to do things like that. And those are practicing principles. Those are things we learn. Well, you know, I practice selfishness. Why wouldn't I practice other things? I mean, I practice selfishness all the time. Why wouldn't I practice other things? And that's what the seven steps all about. It's not finding that glaring defect of character and asking God to remove it. It's doing the little things, the very, very little things, the gentle things, the kind things. It's taking that extra second with the newcomer. You know the one who you don't want to talk to? You know the kind. Everybody's got a few of them around. And I take extra time, and I look at them, and I listen very intently to everything they have to say. And I remember that a guy remembered the names of my kids. I remember that. The guys remember the names of my children. And that's why I'm alive today. See, I can't take a minute for some crazy newcomer. Of course I can. Of course I can. And the other thing I try to do is I try to be very, very considerate of newcomers. Because A lot of old-timers, a lot of people who've been around a while, like to dismiss newcomers as not having anything to say. Well, what could be crazier than that? They have a lot to say, and I need to hear it. No one told me to keep my mouth shut. One guy told me to shut up and take the cotton out of my ears and put it in my mouth, and I attacked him. I did. I'm not proud of this. I physically attacked a man in an AA meeting. I was sober 5 weeks. He had the wrong guy. That's all. He just picked the wrong guy. Very poor judgment. I had gone out to pick somebody up for a meeting, and we were coming back, and I cut in front of a guy, and he got mad and cut me off, and I went across the median and tried to run him off the road. I mean, I think it's a perfectly normal thing to do. And so I'm with a woman who's smoking a cigarette, and she looked at me, and she says, "My, you're a reactor, aren't you?" And I thought, what's with her? You know, I don't understand this. So we go to the meeting, and this guy, I won't tell you his name, he's dead now, but he used to do this all the time. He'd just insult people. He's just an insulting man. And I was saying, "God, if there is a God, please don't let him say anything to me." And he got to me and he said, you little so-and-so. He said, "You ought to take the cotton out of your ears and put it in your mouth. You don't know nothing." And the next thing I knew, I'm strangling this guy on the table. It's a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm strangling this guy. And I just knew I was going to be evicted. And then a group applauded. And said, I did. So we were waiting for a long time for somebody crazy enough to come along and shut him up. And we're glad it was you. Welcome. We're glad to have you. I try to remember that I didn't like being treated like that. He didn't like it much either, but I didn't like being treated like that. And I try to remember that with new folks. I try to remember the old timers in our program. I really try to remember them. I try to remember to thank them for what they've given me. They've given me everything I have. And I try to remember to thank them for that. And especially the ones that sometimes get too sick to come. And I like to remember to go see them or to call them up and see how they're doing and that sort of thing. It's all about being thoughtful. And that's what character building is all about. Character building is simply a matter of putting other people in front of me. It's accepting things the way they are, not the way I'd have them be. It's knowing that I have a small place. It's place. It's mine. But it's a small place in this scheme of things. My old sponsor, Sandy, used to tell me, I said, "I don't feel as though I belong." He said, "I know how you feel." He said, I could go to a strange city, and I could be standing on a corner, and someone would come up to me and say, "Excuse me, you're standing in my spot." And he said, "I'd move." And he said, and then later I'd say, "What does he mean, his spot? I got a right to that spot." You know, when I'd be home, I'd be carrying on about this stuff. But that's the way I felt about the world, that I didn't have a place, and I didn't belong. And I do belong. And I believe that I belong when I do a decent job with the second step. That's what makes me fit in. That's what convinces me. I've been told my whole life I'm a child of God. The sixth and seventh step is what got me to really begin to believe that I was a child of God. I was becoming what He would have me be. And the book says that, doesn't it? It says what we don't ask God what we would do. We ask what He would have us be. What would He have me be? I think He'd have me be a kind, considerate, faithful, loving husband. That's what I think He'd have me be. I think He'd have me be a grateful employee, even if I didn't like what they were doing and how they were doing it. I think He would have me be a father, a good father. I think He would have me be a good sponsor. I think He would have me be a good pigeon or baby or sponsee or whatever they're called, and I can't keep up with it. Guys, I sponsor a pigeon. I was a pigeon. They're going to have to be a pigeon. It's just the way it is. But it's what would He have me be? I think He'd have me be kind. I can be caustic, and I can even use humor to cut you, but I don't think He would have me be that. I don't think He would have me appear to be funny at your expense. I don't think He would have me be a gossip. I've done all these things. But one day I had to stop and say, I don't think that's what He would have me be. And the seventh step is a process whereby I come to realize that He can make me what He wants me to be, but I have to give Him access. The sixth step is recognizing I can't do it by myself, and the seventh step is a process of giving God the access to my life so He can do it. I was talking to a friend of mine earlier, and one of the things I try to do every day is I try to read spiritual material. I do some things, okay? One of the things I do, and I've done this my whole life. My mother had us do this. And when we were kids, my mother was a stickler for vocabulary. And she's a woman, astounding woman. She never finished high school. And she was the best read person I've ever met in my life. She read everything. Read everything she lay her hands on. And her retention was amazing. After we all got through high school and most of us went to college and a bunch to graduate school and everything else, Mom goes to high school and gets her high school equivalency diploma. Then she takes her college entrance exams. She scored higher than any of us. And she said, well, why not? I've been through high school 11 times. And she had. She went through with all of us. And an extraordinary woman. But even as a child, we had to take turns, and we had to come up with a word that we didn't know. We'd find a word somewhere that we didn't know. And it didn't matter if other people knew it. What matters is that we didn't know it. And then we'd get a definition for the word, and we'd tell everybody, this is our word for the week, and we'd tell them, and we'd all write it down and write down a definition, and we'd use that word during the course of the week. And I remember one time I ran across the word gaggle. And so we wrote down gaggle and wrote down a definition and everything, and I hadn't used a word, and finally everybody's sitting around a table, and in my family everybody talks at once. And I said to my mother, what a gaggle of idiots we have here. And she said, that's very good, son, that's very good indeed. So I still do that. I still run across the word and I, you know, circle it and I write it down and I go find a definition and I try to use it. Now, why? Well, I think that if I show up and I try to improve my skills, that God uses me better. My goal is to seek and to do God's will. And I think that curbing my bad language helps that. And I think increasing my vocabulary helps that. You know, when I was a little kid, I had a speech impediment. Nobody could understand anything I say. It's a great privilege for me to stand in front of intelligent people like you and speak. And I want to do as good a job as I can do. And so I try to improve my vocabulary to do that. It's not so anybody will think I'm smart. People know better. And none of that even matters, does it? None of that matters. My job is to carry the message. God saved my life to carry the message, and I want to improve that. The other thing I like to do is I want to read something spiritual every day. And the reason I want to read something spiritual every day isn't so I can become spiritual. That isn't what it's about. I believe that there's a spirit man in me. And that's the seventh step essentially tells me that that's the man that can be strengthened. And when I came to you, I was so spiritually ill that the spirit inside of me suffered severe malnutrition. It was nearly dead. It was nearly dead. There was barely a spark alive inside of me. I was so dead that suicide seemed a logical option to me. And then I met you and things began to change in my life. And I began to wake up. And I used to think that I had to decide what I believed and didn't believe. You know, I mean, I had to decide, that makes sense, that doesn't make sense, that's right, that's wrong. And suddenly I realized that, you know, I have a physical man. And like this morning, I ate breakfast and, you know, and I had bacon and eggs and a roll. Now, I didn't tell my body what to do with that. Well, here, bacon, you go to my eyes and roll, you go to my waist. No, forget that. My body knows what to do with the food. I just put it in there. I don't tell it what to do. Why would I tell my spirit what to do with it? If I run it through my brain, there's no life left in it. Who was it? Byron, the great poet Byron, who said death by dissection. Somebody took one of his poems apart to try to understand it. And he said, it's now a corpse. You've killed my poem by taking it apart. And he said, it's death by dissection. Am I supposed to dissect spiritual thoughts so I can understand? I kill them. What I do is I just put it in there. I read scripture. Read it every day. I put it in there. I read something from the big book of the 12 and 12 every day. Yesterday, I read the story of the number three man, Bill D. Again, I love that story. You know, you'll laugh at this, okay? You know the solitaire game in Windows, the Windows computer program, a solitaire game where you can put in the names of whoever you want. Every day, I play a game of solitaire against Bill W., Dr. Bob, and Bill D. And I beat them like a drum. They don't have a chance. The hearts game, I'm sorry. The hearts game, yeah. And, you know, we play hearts, and I play hearts against these three guys, and we play one game a day, and I'm home, and I'm on the computer, and I beat them. And people will say, who's Bill D? I say, he's an old friend of mine. Bill D, he's an old buddy of mine, and Dr. Bob. So I play with these guys every day. But I also read what it is they have to say, and I read something every day. I don't dissect it. I just read it. And then my spirit uses it the way it's supposed to be used. You know, in the old days, the Hebrews, they were always told to meditate on the word. Just to meditate on the word. And that just means to consume it. Consume it. Because that's what drives our spirits. When I lived a life based on selfishness and self-centeredness and what's in it for me and am I going to get ahead and all the rest of it. When I lived a life like that, that drove me. That was my spiritual food. And it was a terrible way to live. And I don't want to live like that anymore. You know, I don't have to. And what I've discovered in the seventh step is I don't have to play. I just plain don't have to play. I was an officer in a corporation at one time, and a lot of the people there just plain didn't like me, and they were always doing these things to try to embarrass me or to show me up or this or that. It used to make them crazy because I wouldn't even pay any attention. You know, I wouldn't even pay any attention. I remember one time they used to have this deal where when the chairman of the board was there, the president and CEO was there, and we're going to have a board meeting, they would always see how he dressed. And then they would dress like he dressed. If he took his jacket off and rolled up his shirt sleeves and loosened his tie, they'd all come in. The other officers would come in with their jackets off, their shirt sleeves rolled up and their ties unloosened. You know? And so I one day saw all that going on, so I came in Bermuda shorts. And he said, at last, the guy who's showing some sense. Well, just make them crazy, you know, just drive them crazy. And I came to realize that I used to live my life planning things like that. If I could make you look bad, I look good. And it's crazy, isn't it? And one day this guy came to me and he said, you know, there are people around here who don't like you, and it's because of your philosophy. And I said, yeah, I suppose so. And he said, it doesn't seem to bother you. And I said to him, I said, I don't worry because I said, I work for a rich Jewish man. He said, I'm not Jewish. I said, I was referring to God. And he said, oh. He said, that makes sense. He said, if you work for God, you really don't worry, do you? And I said, no. I said, I don't worry at all. I said, besides that, I said, you're talking to a guy who's supposed to be under a bridge someplace. And I said, I'm going to leave here and get my new Buick and drive home. And I may stop at the club and play a round of golf. And I said, that's a lot better than a bridge. I said, what am I going to worry about what a bunch of people think of me? And that's the freedom that comes in the seventh step. I was a guy who was so locked into needing affirmation and needing approval from everybody. Tell you, when I was back in college, okay? Now, I love my parents, and I wouldn't change anything about the way I grew up. But you know, when you grow up, you learn things. And so, one of the things that, and I look back on it now, and it's funny now, but these are difficult things to learn. My parents could never congratulate you for what you did. And I remember, I'm sober, I'm back in school. One semester, I carried 5 courses, and I worked full-time, and I went to 7 meetings a week. And I got 4 A's and a B. So now I'm 30 or 31 years old. I called my mother to tell her my grades. I said, Mom, I got my grades back. I got 4 A's and a B. Well, she said what she always said. That's nice, son. What'd you get the B in? You know? And I felt all this stuff I always felt. And finally, I realized it. You know, I went to my sponsor and I was laughing. I said, guess what? I said, and I told him. And he started laughing and he said, why are you going to school? He said, are you going to school to impress your mother? He said, you're a little beyond that, aren't you? He said, are you going to school because you enjoy the education? And I said, I enjoy the education. And he said, do you think you're the only one in the family that she does that to? I started laughing. I said, of course not. So I called my brother, Dumb Denny. You know, next day I called him. I said, hey, Denny. I said, how am I doing? He said, you're doing great. You got 4 A's and a B. He said, you're a lot smarter than me. She told me you're a lot smarter than I am. He said, how am I doing? I said, you're really doing well. You got another promotion. He said, well, great. So the joke was we didn't know how we did. We called each other. Now, I understood those things, and once I understood what drove those things, the need that drove those things, and those are 6 and 7 step issues, okay? My needing to suck from somebody or to pull from somebody or to extract something from somebody in order to go on. Once I understood those issues, it was then easy for me to live life. And I remember I ended up interviewed on a Today show for something, okay? And I knew I was going to be on a day before I knew I was going to be on, so I'm on a Today show. And my brother Terry then, God bless him, was sleeping on a pool table in a bar. And he'd get up early and clean up the bar. That's why they let him sleep on a pool table. Till he had a little bladder problem, and they wouldn't let him sleep on a pool table anymore. But he's cleaning up the bar and saw me on TV, and he called my parents and said, Keith's on TV. And my father, who's used to the old life, said, my God, what has he done now? You know? And he said, no, he's on a Today show. They're going to talk to him on a Today show. Well, you know how they show you before they talk to you, so they show you, it's called something. TV people may know that. But at any rate, so then they interviewed me. And my mother called later, and she said, son, we saw you on a Today show. She said, why didn't you tell us? And I thought, yeah. I didn't say it. Why didn't I? It didn't occur to me to do that. It was part of my job. It was part of my job. Now, this stuff is really, really important because the things that drove my behavior and drive the way I live my life were based on character defects. Those things get changed. The result is that I'm not driven in life anymore. My goals become different. It's to know and to serve God, to carry His message and to do His will. And that has little to do with other people. I mean, I don't have to suck on other people to do that. I need other people. But I don't need from them what I used to need from them. And now this might be a little complicated. And I think it's a little bit, I know it's difficult for me conceptually, but I think this is critically important. And the seventh step is very, very, it's vital, I think, to my existence, because the seventh step is the method and the mechanism whereby I begin a direct partnership with God. The third step, I ask God to take my will in my life, and then I clean myself up and all that stuff. But the seventh step is where I think I join in a partnership with God. I love old Hal M. from Washington, D.C.